I'm Heather Quinlan, and this is Cold Storage. I had been trying to learn about Mildred Archidopane, the Carvel succubus, the she-wolf who, unlike Agnes, was the power behind the throne. But through all the Smithsonian files and newspaper.com articles, and even building a family tree on Ancestry.com, I learned very little. Pretty much everything had to do with the Attorney General's case against Mildred and Robert Davis, and some unflattering quotes that made Mildred sound like more than a secretary. And isn't that the stereotype? Old tycoon goes chasing after young secretary? On paper, it sounds like that, since Mildred had such a prominent role in Tom Carvel's life and estate. But reality tells a much different story. One of the benefits of looking for someone with a name like Archidopane is that when you find that name on Facebook, chances are you found the right family. As a plus, the woman, Mary, and I had a mutual friend, Joanne, and I asked Joanne if she could put in a good word about me in the podcast. And before you could say Archidopane, I had a phone interview with Mary, who's Mildred's niece. Also, apparently in the U.S., they pronounce it Archidopane. Mildred Archidopane was different from many women, especially first-generation Sicilian-American women in the 1960s. But she was still tied to many of the old country's customs, even from Amerenek, New York. This push-pull meant that Mildred made a great living, but like your Shakespearean tragedies, she paid a huge price. I spoke with Mary by phone, and though she didn't want to be recorded, I was allowed to take notes, which I will share with you now. First, Mary was not a fan of Mildred's, partly because she'd seen Mildred reduce Mary's mother to tears, essentially because her mother was Irish and an outsider. Mary's brother, on the other hand, was a few years older and knew Mildred better. He was the one whose college tuition was paid for by Mildred through the Carvel Foundation. Of which Mary said,
"That pissed my brother off because our father wasn't poor. It wasn't that we were desperate. It was Mildred's arrogance."
Mary went on to say that in that era, women usually had two choices for careers, nursing or teaching. But
Millie started in the steno pool. She took secretarial classes and she was quite prolific in her shorthand. At some point, she went from steno pool to a secretarial job in the Carvel offices, and then she became Tom Carvel's personal assistant. My family was very, very proud, and my grandmother bragged, "My daughter works for Tom Carvel." We used to have Carvel coupons, and it was currency to us. You'd give them to a new friend, and especially when my brother and I had parties, my mother would bring Carvel ice cream to the parties. And the Carvel logo, we always had Carvel notepads in our house. It's what's known as brand loyalty. Who would have thought that TV dinners and ice cream would take hold in the American culture? My aunt, for better or for worse, was a very strange character, and she melded well with Tom. My grandfather was very meek, and my grandmother wanted bigger and better. She spoke badly to her children about their father, and Mildred grew up with little respect for him, so there was an enormous hunger for a father figure, Greek being not far off from Sicilian. I think she bonded with him because he was bold, assertive, what a young woman desperate for a mentor was looking for. But as far as an affair goes, I think it was a reciprocal agreement. Millie was 1,000% codependent and emotionally very needy. I don't think Tom Carvel was the type to wine you and dine you and make love to you. She protected him, and he protected her. They also shared that fear of being something they're not, that imposter syndrome. Mildred made a lot of money over time. Carvel went from public to private to public, and her salary went up accordingly. But my aunt didn't know how to handle going from Jane average to someone climbing the levels of success. But we did know Millie was gunning for bear at work as Carvel became more powerful. Who got hired and who got fired was up to Carvel and Millie. Her personality at home and at work were two different things. My grandmother was now elderly. Millie saw that her brother had a family of his own, and she may have been successful at work, but she had no one to come home to except this crotchety old woman. She'd had two boyfriends, but the family nixed them. Then the trickle-down is they treated others badly. She went from being a member of the family to the matriarchal role. My grandmother ruled with an iron fist, but she had to concede every Mussolini gets overthrown. Millie had no kids, no responsibility. But in Italian families, there's always a matriarch. Millie didn't deal with her father's death, and when Tom Carvel died, I think her age settled in and she was no longer going to be the powerhouse, and Pamela, the niece, got to be the power. At Carvel's funeral, it was mostly lawyers. My father went with Mildred. Millie deteriorated quickly because the dynamic in her world changed. She was probably devastated physically as well as emotionally. She became very close to one of the lawyers because she needed friendship, and that was Robert Davis. He was Millie's friend, but he wasn't on the up and up. He used her as a gravy train. He would talk to her at 10 or 11 at night. He would tell her what the opposition was saying. She couldn't sleep. She never saw a doctor. She never took care of herself. She went from overweight to skinny, but that was from stress. My aunt had a lot of spare time and she was devastated and without any kind of attachment, desperate for anyone to love her. I still hated her. She'd forget to take her meds, but my brother would remind her. My aunt died in 2002. There weren't a lot of people who loved my aunt. It wasn't a large funeral. There was a woman who sold ad space in the Mamaroneck Yellow Pages who was killed in a car accident. The community who bought advertising from her waited in line. It was standing room only for that woman's wake. Mildred could have taken a totally different tack, and that would have been her legacy. Instead, that fear factor. Nobody respected her. Nobody loved her. Nobody missed her. And look at Tom Carvel. Everything the store needed had to be bought from the home office. Bruce Carvel was not ignorant, and Tom was not a genius. They stayed up hundreds of nights in their earliest days thinking, how can we make money in perpetuity? Tom saw himself as a part of a bigger picture. It is a success story, and it is greed, and it is big and vast. I mean, there are so many people who started their career at Carvel, their first job out of college. But then there are so many random missing pieces.
I guess monsters are not born, but are made. And as Paul Harvey would have said,
and now you know the rest of the story.
Now you know the rest of the story. At least the story of Mildred Arcata Payne. Up next, the death of Tom Carvel and the insanity that became his legacy. My husband and I have been binging on The Sopranos. He'd never seen it, and it had been years for me. In one episode, Tony is warned by his lawyer to spend more time at his on-the-books job at Barone Sanitation than at his informal office, a strip club called the Bada Bing. Barone cleared out a room full of boxes and set up an office for Tony, and Tony didn't even have to do anything while he was there. No scheduling, no mailing paychecks. The most he had to do was show up. He could spend the day sleeping. But Tony Soprano, a man who ordered murders and committed many himself, and helped dismember two of his capos, could not handle an office job. He just couldn't do it. His arm even broke out in a rash. He was allergic to the grind. It was as if he took a 9-to-5 guy and made him boss of a family. He might break out in a rash or possibly worse. Definitely a sweat. This would make a great Freaky Friday. In any case, Tony lasted maybe 10 days, enough time to have a quickie with the office assistant, but the lack of any other action meant he'd rather take his chances getting caught by the feds and spend another day behind a desk. On some level, we can all relate. I had a job where I got a 6:50 a.m. train to New Jersey and barely made it into Lower Manhattan by 9. After the millionth, no exaggeration, time that New Jersey transit lines were delayed, I would have happily taken over the Lucchese family. But I'm a woman and only 6% Sicilian. That's not to say that Tom Carvel was Don Corleone, though he did have certain tendencies when it came to cracking down on his franchisees. In a lawsuit between Tom Carvel and store owner John Koufakis, whom Carvel put out of business, Koufakis' attorney, Irving M. Berg, likened Tom Carvel to a mob boss. He told jurors that Carvel coerced the little guys in his organization by causing the same kind of terror the mafia did to keep its soldiers in line. I will say, here's a great example of how Carvel converged his A-list connections with his passive-aggressive policies towards his franchisees. Danny Thomas was famous in the 50s and 60s as an actor and founder of St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. And Carvel was putty in his hand since Thomas was also a celebrity and golfer, two things Carvel loved. In the 70s, Carvel advanced the St. Jude Hospital $100,000 and expected his store owners to participate as well, donating 50 cents from every cake sold to St. Jude. A 30-second spot was aired on the local station WOR, and a letter was sent to store owners informing them of their participation in this program, along with some FAQs. Here's one. Question. What about stores that may elect not to participate? Answer. As Carvel is a family and community-oriented business, the worst exposure for a store would be not to help such a worthy cause. However, should there be a few stores who still elect not to join this most meaningful chain-wide effort, they will not receive the St. Jude participating window decal, posters, or labels. What's left out is, Carvel would also know exactly who you were. And here's my co-host, Paul Finnegan. Paul?
In his summation, attorney Irving Berg referred to Tom Carvel as the top leader of the mafia in a business way. When Carvel's lawyers asked the judge to instruct the jury to disregard any reference to the mafia, the judge said, yes, they understand that Mr. Berg is not accusing Mr. Carvel of being a mafia member. I think the judge was wrong. This was extremely prejudicial, but Carvel won anyway. In fact, Tom Carvel could not lose a case. Not against the FTC, not against the Attorney General, not against the little guys. He was, in a way, the Teflon Don.
But there were so many cases, and at this point Carvel was getting so old, that he began to question if it was worth it. Tony Soprano did the same in practically every episode. Even the pilot has him saying,
it's good to be in something from the ground floor. I came too late for that. I know. But lately I'm getting the feeling that I came in at the end. The best is over.
Many Americans, I think, feel that way.
I think about my father. He never reached heights like me. But in a lot of ways, he had it better. He had his people. They had their standards. They had pride. Today, what do we got?
Tom Carvel, unlike Tony Soprano, laid the foundation, built the ground floor, added story after story, and gained as many as 800 franchises around the country. But then, as with the mob, and interestingly, an attorney general was involved in wearing down both Carvel and the mafia, he saw the handwriting on the wall. A wall he'd built. Stores plummeted to half their numbers. Standalone stores that made Carvel look like Syosset's answer to the Bellagio were now becoming a cog in a shopping plaza. And there was money to be made in supermarkets.
Also, Carvel wanted to golf. As we mentioned, the Carvel estate in Pine Plains had been bought with the intent of turning it into a dairy farm. But since no one cared if they saw a cow or not, Carvel transformed it into a pro-am golf course, with funding from friends, both A-list and shady, sometimes both, like Lee Iacocca, Bob Hope, Perry Como, Jackie Gleason, and George Steinbrenner. Though a 1983 article in New York Magazine with the headline Steinbrenner wants out of Carvel Club would imply otherwise. Not only did Steinbrenner threaten to sue Carvel for illegally using his name as a member of Carvel's country club to sell $5,000 per year memberships, the lawyer who demanded Steinbrenner's name be removed was Roy Cohn, as in Senator Joe McCarthy's Roy Cohn. This would scare the hell out of me, but I am not Tom Carvel. The article ends with a Carvel exec asserting that Steinbrenner is a charter member. And then there was limo king Bill Fugazi. If Tom Carvel had a BFF, it was Bill frickin' Fugazi. But don't let the name fool you. This was not one of the nouveau riche flaunting his money. Fugazi was from a Genoese Italian banking family, started by his grandfather Luigi Fugazi, who changed the name to sound more American. Luigi was a Tammany Hall player, liaising between the Irish and Italians. He also promoted over 100 Italian fraternal organizations and was such a beloved philanthropist the Times called him Papa Fugazi. Gay Talese said he was perhaps the most eminent padrone in the United States, and Fiorella LaGuardia was at his funeral along with 1,000 others.
Fugazi's grandson, on the other hand, loved golf, boxing, and living comfortably outside the law. Fugazi had named one of his sons Roy after Roy Cohn. The two friends went way back, and in 1961, Cohn had been Fugazi's partner in boxing promotion and crime. By 1963, Fugazi was testifying against Cohn in a perjury suit. Described as depraved, psychopathic, and a man who lies to your face and believes his own lies by Customato, Mike Tyson's famous trainer, Fugazi was also, by his own accounts, a devout Catholic, the youngest person to be knighted by the Pope, probably due to his family's ties to the Vatican, and had the ear of both Cardinal Spellman and John F. Kennedy. And it was probably Fugazi who arranged for Bobby Kennedy to have a campaign lunch at Carvel's motel 4 months before he was assassinated at the Ambassador Hotel. As an aside, in 2016, Rudy Giuliani said at Fugazi's memorial service, "I could not have been mayor without Bill Fugazi."
Leaving boxing for the limousine business, Fugazi continued to build on his nouveau riche mythology, and Carvel loved it. Carvel used his whale of a muscle to get Bob Hope to do a Fugazi limo commercial.
"Hi, this is Bob Fugazi, Continental Hope, announcing the expansion of Fugazi Continental's limousine service. Reserve a Fugazi sedan or limousine for a fine ride and maximum comfort.
Call 718-762-9100.
And Fugazi was one of the investors in Carvel's All-American Sports City, an 850-acre sports complex that would include housing for people who wanted quick access to sports facilities. Bob Hope was its honorary chairman. Fugazi was president. Over the course of 30 years, it never got off the ground, and people lost millions, Carvel included. Still, the two stayed in lockstep, with Fugazi claiming to have a weekend home on the Pine Plains estate, which he used to house his attack German shepherds after too many complaints by his neighbors.
When we started this podcast, it was to be a true crime story dedicated to finding out, as best we could, whether Tom Carvel died of natural causes or was murdered. Skullduggery, open questions, suspicion. The answer remains unknown. But there was definitely crime around him. Perhaps Carvel died of natural causes. Perhaps it was like murder on the Orient Express where everyone did it. Carvel certainly didn't stand on ceremony when it came to a police record. In fact, it seemed the dirtier, the better.
Take arson. Three buildings on Carvel property burned down within 7 years. The final two only 6 months apart. "Fire destroys Carvel estate barn," said a 1977 headline. A fire caused by lightning destroyed the residence of Sports City owner Tom Carvel, read a line in a July 1983 newspaper. And in January 1984, police treating Sports City clubhouse fire as arson. The article ended with, "This was the second major fire at All-American Sports City in the past year. Carvel's home was partially destroyed by fire attributed to lightning this past summer." What arson investigators turned up is unknown. But how is this not suspicious? And if it was arson, I doubt an elderly man and his wife could have caused them. Then again, the building in Mechanicville, New York, that Carvel took over in 1938 had previously been gutted by a fire. But like the countless franchisee cases, nothing stuck. And I'm sure Tom Carvel had no idea that the opposite would be true after he died. Because for a man who built an empire through care and commitment, his estate looks like it was planned by a lunatic. Here's what we mean. By 1989, all the court cases, home fires burning and fraud charges, meaning Sports City homes were built and sold, but then the owners were barred from entering, not to mention old age, were getting to Carvel. So after years of talking about selling his company, he actually did it. Investcorp, which at the time was part owner of Tiffany and Gucci, took on the gold standard of soft serve for $80 million, which sounds like a whale of a deal, but it was far less than the company should have been worth. By then, it was reported to have 700 stores, though the number was closer to half that. And Carvel was by then the third largest ice cream operation in the U.S., not the first, the bronze standard.
Then less than a year later, on October 21st, 1990, Tom Carvel died, whether by natural causes or nefarious ones. His estate was worth about $200 million, and Carvel's will left all his assets to his wife Agnes in trust for life, with the remainder payable on Agnes's death to the Thomas and Agnes Carvel Foundation. At the time of Carvel's death, Agnes had a mirror image will, which meant hers and Tom's were identical and could not be changed. Suffice it to say, Agnes barely ever saw a dime. Carvel's biggest mistake? He had 7 executors. The idea was that these 7 people would form a system of checks and balances on how all this money was spent through trusts and foundations, but try getting 7 people to agree on anything, especially when hundreds of millions of dollars are involved, and 2 of the 3 were forced to step down from the foundation because they stole from it. Here are the 7 executors. Agnes Carvel, who may or may not have been mentally competent by then and eventually stepped down. Tom's niece, Pamela Carvel. Agnes's niece, Betty Godley. Betty and Pamela hated each other. Mildred Arcata Payne and Robert Davis, the 2 who had to step down from the foundation or go to federal prison. Herbert Roth, Carvel's longtime lawyer. And Judge Anthony Serrato, who died before this whole thing was over.
This June 15th, 1998 article from Forbes says it all. This was written nearly 8 years after Carvel died. Scene: a small courtroom on the 8th floor of a bland pink granite office building on the unfashionable fringes of downtown White Plains, New York. Late April. A dozen of the lawyers contesting the estate of the ice cream magnate Thomas Carvel have gathered before Judge Albert J. Emanuele of the Westchester Surrogates Court. "I came here in 1991, and this case is still being litigated," the judge told the assembled attorneys. 7 years of litigation, I think it's tragic. What could have been a $200 million estate has dwindled to about $60 million. Carvel wanted his money to benefit his frail widow and local charities, but the latest recipients of that money so far have been the lawyers.
Now, that having been said, our guest today is a wonderful lawyer. Hello to Danielle Mayoris, estate planning attorney and co-author of Trial and Heirs, Famous Fortune Fights, which is about celebrity estates and what they did wrong and what they did right. And Danielle, thank you for coming. And I wanted to ask you, Tom Carvel would seem to be a great subject for this book if you could tell us a little about his estate.
Tom Carvel was someone who had about a $200 million estate. And so, you know, a lot of times people think, oh, this person has so much money and they did everything right because you can hire the best people. But as you and I both know, it doesn't always work that way. And it didn't work that way in Carvel's case, not because he didn't try to do all this planning. He did all the planning, but there were still a lot of hiccups after he passed away.
Let's talk about like what some of that planning was that he did in terms of having 7 executors. Why would someone do that?
Well, Tom Carvel was someone who seemed to like a lot of control. He did at least 6 different estate planning entities that we know of. And so obviously this was someone who really wanted to dot his I's and cross his T's, but he almost overdid it because even though he took care to do charitable planning and plan for tax liability and tried to do all these things, he made some mistakes because he almost overplanned. If you can imagine 7 people trying to sign off on everything, trying to agree on everything, that is just a recipe for disaster. And in Carvel's case, he named a variety of people. He had professionals named, like his attorney and a judge. He had his widow named with other family members, like his niece and his wife's niece. And then he also had his secretary, Mildred, included as an executor as well. So these 7 people came from all different walks of life, and they had to try and work together to get anything done under his probate estate. And to make things even more complicated, under his will, allegedly, there were 83 bequests to different individuals. That is extremely unusual. That means there were 83 different individuals listed who received different portions of money under his estate. Clearly, the way he did this is he did not want to give that money away during his lifetime. So we can only imagine how time-consuming that would be and administratively complicated it would be. So when you couple that process with seven different executors, it just magnifies the problems that a lot of families already have.
And he and Agnes, his wife, had what is known as a mutual will.
They had mutual wills. They have like an agreement under the mutual wills that they won't amend or revoke them without the consent of the other. So when the first spouse passes away, it's sealed, it's irrevocable. So they were really ensuring that when one of them passed away, the other wouldn't do anything that they didn't want them to do. It's most likely that Tom was the one who wanted this because he wanted to make sure that if he passed away, his widow wasn't going to do something different with his money than what he wanted. So basically, it's a form of control. It's an agreement ahead of time that you're both going to have the same wishes and you're both going to carry out each other's intent no matter who dies first.
Sometimes there's such a thing as too much control, I think. Or,
you know what? Too much control when you don't know what you're doing. I mean, perhaps the professionals he worked with, you know, they knew his personality and they thought, well, he's going to do what he wants to do. So we just have to do it. We don't really know what went on behind closed doors, but you would hope that the professionals around him wouldn't just be yes type of people and that they would say, you know, this really isn't in your best interest. Let's take another look at this. I'm concerned for you, as opposed to just letting him call every single shot. It's a kind of a fine line when we're talking about estate planning, because it is all about the client's wishes and their goals. But at the same time, they rely on us as the professionals to make sure that what they want to accomplish is done the most efficient, effective way. And looking at what we know publicly about Tom Carvel's estate, it doesn't really appear that that was the case.
And Danielle, you bring up a good point. My colleague here, Paul, recently spoke with Sean O'Dowd, who's the managing director at Silvercrest Asset Management, and who also knows about those challenges. Over to you, Paul.
So Sean O'Dowd, in your experience, do you have any cautionary tales for someone like a Tom Carvel or a family that's in such a position?
Let me put it this way. When I come into a situation involving a wealthy family, and just by the nature of becoming that trusted advisor, you find yourself dealing with their counsel and get to know the counsel and so forth. And quite often, a lot of these individuals, they usually have outgrown their will. And for whatever reason, their counsel does not want to bring the subject up. And that's because it's a touchy subject, as we all know. This idea of mortality, right? No one wants to talk about it. And I find myself, either I'll bring it up or I'll encourage counsel to bring it up again. Because if you have inadequate, you know, estate planning, and God forbid this matriarch or patriarch passes away, the next generation is stuck in this conundrum or a messy situation, or a messy and very expensive situation that was completely avoidable. And they're going to look at you and say, hey, wait a minute, weren't you my dad or mom's advisor? Like, why did you let this happen? And that account or that relationship is going to, you're going to lose it. And I think, you know, there's a statistic out there in terms of when men pass away, let's say the husband in the relationship passes away first, 90% of the time, the spouse will basically take the funds wherever they're being managed and move them away. And it's because there's just lack of communication. They're not very happy with sort of what has taken place. And it's totally avoidable. And the first thing you need to do is communication. So communication begins with the advisor to the individual, to the business owner, to Mr. Carvel, and having a very good relationship, a very honest relationship. So as opposed to, oh, I'll just do whatever you want and not challenge them. And, you know, that with hard charging business owners and entrepreneurs, that's not always an easy thing to do. I mean, they have you know, very dynamic personalities, if you will. And so,
strong.
Yeah, you know, that's, I mean, they've gotten there for a reason, right? You know, And not everybody has the personality to kind of go there. And sometimes they're going to say, well, this is what I want. And you're going to have to tell them, well, having 12 trustees is not a good idea. You know, in the case of Mr. Carvel or whatever it was, that's not a solid way to do things. You gotta simplify it. At a prior work experience, if you want a case study, I had a situation where the business owner passed away. He had a separate will for his son from someone else who wasn't his wife. And his family, his existing family, try and keep this as redacted as possible, was unaware of this. And this created at least 3 to 4 years worth of work, not only selling the business, but also getting the right legal representation for the family. And it cost $3.5 to $4 million in legal fees. And it created a lot of, it created a lot of drama, and it was completely avoidable. And we just wished, it's like, if you could just let us know that there was this other issue out there, you know, we could have given you the guidance that you needed.
Thank you to Sean O'Dowd. I have learned that this can be a challenging job at times. And Danielle, I wanted to talk to you a bit about Pamela and Mildred and Robert.
You know, a couple of the people were prominent in his life, but not always without strife. For instance, Carvel's secretary, Mildred, she wasn't really like a typical secretary. I mean, this is a secretary who made millions of dollars even while Carvel was alive doing her job. And she controlled everything. She even went against her boss, locking him out of the office so that he would have to buy her gifts to get his way back in, which is completely insane. You can see how the hierarchy was very confusing with the amount of control that she had. And allegedly, later on in his life, before he passed away, she had the nerve to take some of the corporate files out of the office and take them to her personal home. And of course, when he found out about this, he was angry, he was shocked. He went to get those items back, and he fired both his secretary, Mildred, and his attorney, Robert Davis. And it was the next day that he allegedly had a heart attack and died. His niece, Pamela, actually wanted his body exhumed and wanted them to do an autopsy to check and see if he actually passed away from a heart attack or what caused the heart attack. And from my understanding, the medical examiner said his signature was forged on the death certificate. So when we couple that with the timing of when Tom Carvel passed away and some other questionable things that happened, it seems like she has a really legitimate suspicion at the very least. And this is very, very important because in the estate planning world, if you kill someone, then you lose any interest in that person's estate. And of course, when you look at Mildred and Robert, his secretary and attorney, you see what a prominent role or roles both of them played in Tom Carvel's estate. And when you play roles like an executor or director, you are paid for that, in addition to possibly being beneficiaries under his estate. So if it were actually true, and his secretary Mildred and his attorney Robert did either kill Tom Carvel or conspire to kill him, then they couldn't inherit under his estate. And they clearly would not have been executors or directors under his legal entities that he set up.
And indeed, they were fired from his foundation for financial improprieties, correct?
Correct. They were fired. They're actually, the New York Attorney General got involved, and they found that there were gifts to some of their family members, paying for tuition, and all sorts of self-dealing involved.
And that brings up one thing, and I think you mentioned it without mentioning its legal term, but Slayer statute, if you could explain what that is.
Yes, yes. The Slayer statute essentially means if you kill someone, then you're going to lose any interest in the person's estate. And that's really critical. And I tried to research if New York had a statute of limitations on that. And from what I saw, if there is some very egregious types of felonies like murder and rape, there generally is not, they don't have a statute of limitations in New York on the Slayer statute. It sounds like Pamela legitimately had a good case. The problem for Pamela was when she wanted to have Tom Carvel's body exhumed and really look into this, she filed that in Florida instead of in New York where he passed away.
And Florida has jurisdiction to exhume anyone in New York, correct?
Correct. Correct. Florida did not have jurisdiction. And so, of course, she could have filed in New York. But, you know, we all have to keep in mind is when you go through this legal process, it's very expensive, it's very time consuming, and it's emotionally draining. And if she went through this process in Florida just to come to a dead end, for her to then start it again in New York, we don't know what kind of resources she had at her disposal, emotionally, you know, what kind of toll this took on her. It's really can be a lot navigating and going through the court system, especially when it's an adversarial process. One thing I want to make sure whenever someone is, you know, in the public looking at lawsuits and cases, something to keep in mind is it's not always about principle. Sometimes lawsuits and cases are about, you know, who has the most endurance. And in Carvel's case, various attorneys who were involved in, we're talking about tens of millions of dollars in attorney fees. It can take years to have something resolved. So I think it's really easy for us to say, well, why didn't Pamela file in New York? Or I don't understand, this seems unfair. But when you understand the court process, you have to take all these other things into account as well.
Thank you, Danielle Mayoris, for your insights. And her book, Trial and Heirs, Famous Fortune Fights, which was written with her husband, Andy, is available on Amazon. I've read it and I highly recommend. I'm going to risk copyright issues by adding this Carvel commercial because I don't want cold storage, although a podcast about the life and death and possible murder of Tom Carvel, to end on a low note. This will also put to bed any questions as to whether Carvel ice cream is made in Alsace-Lorraine.
What is the secret of Carvel's ice cream? It's made fresh in the ice cream store using the Carvel patented ice cream machine, and we do not use an air pump. You get more fresh ice cream, less air at Carvel. All the Carvel products are American. No, we're not Swedish. We're not Alsace-Lorraine. We're not French. We don't pretend to be. It's just plain good old American dairy products made fresh. We're proud of it.
I love this ad because it's got Carvel's voice and it's goofy, like Cookie Puss, and it's all those things you loved about the man and his ice cream. So what are we to conclude as we bring cold storage to an end? I suppose that Tom Carvel overcame poverty, built an empire, and could be a generous man or your worst enemy. In short, a man of contradictions. We learn that ice cream can bring a lot of drama. But that can be the case for any business, especially a family business. Think back to Crazy Eddie. One thing we do know for sure, for all his human-like qualities, successes and failures, in business and as a person, there will never be another man like Tom Carvel again. I'm Heather Quinlan, and this has been Cold Storage. And a huge thank you to everyone who contributed in no particular order. We've got Trav SD, Don Ward Lau, Adam McGovern, Kenny Stimmick, Catherine Crispin, Russ Hodge, Freddie Hodge, Ginger Hendy, Mike Insetta, Michelle Lacanto Munn, Eric Munn, EJ Williams, Dave Barkow, Costa Costamatides, Robin Beatty, the Carvel worker who wishes to remain nameless, Nancy Richards, Stuart Jacobson, Tom Nealon, Gary Weiss, Brian McCabe, Mike Shane, Tara Cox, Danielle Mayoris, Mary Arcata Payne, Kathy Beal, Sean O'Dowd, Liz Prestouris, Nancy Quinlan LaShore, the Smithsonian Institution, and most of all, roving reporter Bridget Bartolini, my partner in crime Paul Finnegan, and all you Carvel fans. Thank you.